Welcome to Appointed.
Okay, well, it's my profound pleasure to be launching 2021 in our first podcast on Appointed with two amazing guests. I'm joined today by Asante Houghton and Rachel Bromberg to talk about mental health crisis responses, something that's been very much not just in the news, but in the public sphere. And for me very personally, I spent a fair bit of the last couple of weeks on streets and psych hospitals, dealing with police, dealing with folks in the community, because of course this is, you know, the holidays are often a time when people are particularly struggling. And so, both of you have been working on a network that you've founded, Reach Out Response Network. As I understand it, it's a network that's dedicated to shifting mental health crisis responses away from the coercive, forceful, police-led types of interventions, and instead looking at a more anti-oppressive, trauma-informed model that informs individual crisis and really allows people to be treated in a humane, caring, compassionate way, and minimizes the likelihood that we'll end up with the kinds of, you know, some horrendous situations that have happened in the past that we'll get to. Mr. Houghton, you are an award-winning mental health advocate. You're a peer worker, a poet, a thinker, a speaker who believes in people, global interconnectivity and positive personal change. And I was really pleased to, I'm going to tell everybody, and maybe we'll put it in the show notes if you're okay, for people to go to your TED Talk. And Rachel, you're studying law, you know, just starting a second term and second year. And you're also trained in social work. You're a peer supporter. You're an educator and have worked with such organizations as Planned Parenthood, Canadian Suicide Prevention Service, and others. And so amazing already you are leading in these areas. And I want to hear a bit about why you decided to set up the Reach Out Response Network. And as I was reading a bit about what you've been doing, I was reminded that back in 40, 50 years ago, when I was a teenager, I actually had the privilege and responsibility of working in a crisis center where we actually did what were referred to as suicide flying squads, where we actually went out and received calls from people, including sometimes the police, that people were in mental health crisis, and went out and were trained and participated in supporting individuals. But with the evisceration of social programs, health programs, support services, with the spilling of people literally into the streets as part of the deinstitutionalizing of psychiatric hospitals, of other kinds of institutions, but without the requisite resources in place, we've seen massive numbers of people literally being dumped into the streets, into jails, and sometimes into very life-threatening situations, some of which I know you have been also involved with. So I'm very interested in what experience has brought you to work on this project, as well as if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what the Reach Out Response Network is, how you see it working, why you've developed it, and what role you see it playing going forward in society. So I don't know, Santi, if you want to start, and then Rachel.
At first, thank you for the intro and all of that, and also for the plug for the TED Talk. So anyone listening, please go out and watch it. It's on YouTube. What got me interested in this, I think first and foremost, is my own life experience. I'm someone who has a history of mental illness, so to speak, depression and anxiety and suicidality and that sort of thing. And that started for me when pretty much right when I became a teenager. And then at the same time, simultaneously, you know, during that time of my life, my mom was also experiencing, similar, but probably more severe symptoms as well, including, visual and auditory hallucinations. So hearing voices, seeing things that, you know, others couldn't perceive, as well as experiencing some pretty serious delusions of prosecution. So her illness and mine, put us both in a position where we were in frequent, for a few years in frequent contact with the system in a variety of different ways, you know, a lot of police officers in particular. So, you know, that was kind of my experience growing up. And then as I got older, you know, I just became more and more interested in, you know, the psychology of things, so to speak, from a social perspective, but also, you know, from the perspective of mental health. And of course, you know, my experience as a Black male is intertwined in all of that. And, you know, then I started working in mental health and community work pretty much right out of my graduation of my undergrad. And I've been doing that now for about 10 years. So, you know, and so I've experienced crisis. I've seen others in my family experience crisis, and I've seen, you know, people I work with experience crisis as well, or distress, if you want to use a different word. And, you know, all of these experiences kind of added up for me, and, you know, kind of put it right in front of my face that, you know, the system is not necessarily working for a lot of us who do experience, you know, high levels of distress. And, you know, I wanted to make a difference, and I wanted to make a change. And, you know, it just so happened that, you know, serendipitously, Rachel and I worked at the same place, and, you know, she had similar thoughts, and we just got to talking, and, well, I'll let her tell the rest of the story.
Right, Rachel?
Yeah, so I've also been working in mental health for about 7 years now, and I've done a lot of work with suicide intervention services. And one of the things that I noticed a lot was that often when I would be talking to people who are calling the service because they were in a suicidal crisis, often people would be quite hesitant to share about what was actually going on for them, or whether they, like, what the extent of their suicidal thinking was, because they were concerned that if they shared what was actually going on, then I would be obligated to call police, and police would respond to them to deal with that mental health crisis, and that would be a scary or traumatic experience for them. A lot of the times I was talking to people who had had these kinds of experiences before, and those experiences with police hadn't led to people actually getting the help that they needed, and they had just made people feel scared to even reach out for help or talk about what they were going through. So I really saw this as a barrier that, you know, if people are so afraid of getting this kind of response, they can't even talk about what's going on to, like, to a crisis worker, that's a big problem. So Asante and I, we used to work together at a youth mental health agency called Go's Place, and we spent a lot of time talking about this problem. And at a certain point, we thought, you know, there must be other places in other cities that are doing a better job than we are at responding to this problem. There must be innovative solutions happening somewhere. So we started doing some research, and we started talking to lots of different people in Toronto to understand the system better and to understand why it exists the way it does. And we started to do some research into what other cities are doing in response to this problem. And we learned about different teams in Eugene, Oregon, and Stockholm, Sweden, and Denver, Colorado, and Austin, Texas, and lots of different places that have developed civilian-led mental health emergency services that respond to people in crisis instead of police responding. And initially, when we got interested in this and we're talking to lots of people about it, about 2 years ago now, there wasn't a lot of interest from government or from the power players at that time. But last year, between April and June, when five Canadians experiencing mental health crisis ended up dying or being killed during interactions with police, the city of Toronto, as well as many other cities across Canada and across the U.S. at this time as well, completely changed their tune about what needed to happen in response to this problem. So at that time, City Council in Toronto voted in June of last year to build or to develop a framework for how to build a new mental health emergency service in Toronto. And it was voted through unanimously by city council. And Asante and I were sort of like, hey, we've done all of this research. We know about all these different models, all these best practices. We know what the challenges are and the opportunities are for implementing this kind of model in a big city like Toronto. And we met with city staff and we met with the Toronto Police Services Board staff. And we basically said, you know, we can support you in putting together this the framework for this new team. So we officially incorporated as a nonprofit, the Reach Out Response Network. We found that as we, you know, got a little bit of publicity and people heard about what we were doing, lots of people wanted to get involved. Like we went from, you know, in May of last year when it was just me and Asante to by September, me and Asante and hundreds of people who had attended our town halls, hundreds of people who are interested in volunteering with us, like a lot of dozens of people who sat on our advisory panels, our advisory council. It was just like an overwhelming and really, really exciting interest from the community. And we got a contract with the City of Toronto to do a whole bunch of community engagement and to put together a report to provide to city staff that would basically detail everything we were hearing about what the community wanted to see in these new teams, as well as all the research we'd done, the international models we were looking at, and what the best practices are. And over 3 months, we held 18 town halls. We did two large surveys. We did probably about 120 individual interviews or key stakeholder interviews. We took all that information, we compiled it into a report, and we provided that report to city staff. And basically in that report, and the report's actually available on our website at reachouttoronto.ca if people are interested in it. But in the report, we basically recommended that the City of Toronto develop a new mental health emergency service that would be staffed by mental health clinicians like social workers, psychotherapists, as well as peer workers from the communities they serve. So peer workers are people who have their own lived experience of mental health or substance use, and have also received a lot of training in how to leverage that lived experience to support other people who've experienced similar challenges. So we recommended that the team would be made up, or the new teams would be made up of peer workers and mental health clinicians. And we recommended that the new teams would be accessible both through 911 dispatch, because we heard from the community that 911 is often the only number people know to call when they're in crisis or when their family members or friends are in crisis. 911 is the number that people are trained since childhood. When there's an emergency, you should call here. But then we also heard the importance of having a separate number that people could call to access the new service as well. So we recommended that there be multiple avenues to access the service, including 911 and including its own number. And we recommended that the teams should be available across the city 24/7. With immediate response times, just like police, just like fire, just like ambulance. And city staff liked our recommendations. So what's moving forward in Toronto now is that this proposal that we've made that city staff have agreed with is going to be sent to executive committee in Toronto on January 27th. It'll be voted on in council in early February, and the plan is to have some pilots operational for this new service in January 2022.
Okay, well, that's fascinating, and thank you for all the incredible work you both have been doing, as well as it sounds like a legion of volunteers that are also working with you. It's heartening to hear that out of such horrendous tragedies, and with the exposure during this health and economic pandemic and the pandemic of racism that has been exposed, that we see something positive coming out. And it sounds like both of you and the folks you're working with have done a tremendous job of turning what have been some horrendous horrible tragedies around and ensuring that people can move forward in a more positive way. Because as you've mentioned, there are many people know to call 911. And right now, usually that involves a police intervention. And some police can be very good. But as we know from far too many incidents of people being harmed or dying or being put in jail essentially because of mental health issues or being left to languish on the streets, that we need to have a different approach. And in large part too, we need to have an approach that involves the caring, compassion, and the knowledge of the resources that are available, many of which have been not available for far too long. So when someone calls you or calls the network, or if they call 911 and they're redirected, how will it look different? What will the interventions look like that you're proposing? So if I'm calling because, you know, someone I know or love is in crisis and I call 911 and say, you know, if I know about the network and I say, but I really want to actually deal with the Reach Out Response Network, or even if I don't, how does that happen? What will the steps be to ensure 911 dispatchers know? And then what will you actually be doing when you intervene?
So I guess one thing that I'd like to clarify is just that it's not going to be the Reach Out Response Network that's directly operating the service. We're working with the city to develop a framework for what the service would look like. But what's actually going to be happening for the pilots is that the City of Toronto is going to be selecting several anchor agencies. So what the city's planning on doing now is operating four different pilots, one of which would be an Indigenous specific pilot. So it would be run by an Indigenous agency. It would serve Indigenous communities specifically. The oversight body would be completely Indigenous. So, and then there would be three other pilots that would just serve everyone within a given community in different parts of the city. So what is expected to happen is that there will be like an expression of interest that will go out where agencies who want to operate the service will be able to apply and say, you know, we want to operate the service in this area. And how that would work from the point of view of the call maker. So if whichever number that, like, let's say I have a friend or family member who is experiencing a mental health crisis. I can call whichever number I know to call. Let's say, just for simplicity's sake, I call 911 because that's the number I know to call. 911 dispatcher would ask me some questions to determine, is this a call that should go to the police? Is there, you know, is there a crime being committed, for example? You know, is there a really dangerous weapon involved, for example, or is this a mental health crisis call? And if it's a mental health crisis call, the 911 dispatcher would transfer the call to the dispatch center for the new service. And in the pilot phase, the service will only be available in a certain number of areas. So you would obviously need to determine whether the person in crisis is in one of the catchment areas. But if they are, then whichever agency is operating the service in that area would send out their team. So it would be a clinician paired with a peer worker. And they would go out and they would just meet the person wherever they're at. They would provide the person, like they would de-escalate the crisis. They would provide the person with any kind of referrals that might be necessary. What we know from our research and from talking to community members is often, like, people in crisis, they don't always need to go to the hospital. Sometimes they do. And if they, you know, if the person wanted to go to the hospital, the team could take them there and sit with them, stay with them if they wanted that. But a lot of the times they just need to be reconnected to resources they've previously accessed, or they just, you know, they need a safe place to stay for a couple of days. Maybe they need access to crisis beds. So the team could transport someone. It's going to be really flexible. It's going to be about, you know, what does this person need in this moment to get through this moment of crisis? How can we help them stay safe? And it'll be really focused on that.
So it sounds like a lot of individualized support and assistance once it's up and going, and as you've said, tailored to the needs of the individuals, but also tapping into existing resources. So it's not so much creating an entirely new response approach as it is to really, it sounds also like you're training existing service providers or connecting existing service providers to the 911 emergency services so that it's better supports, more immediate, and less likely to involve police interventions, and certainly less likely to involve volatile situations. Is that accurate, or am I missing something?
I would say yes. You know, to add, one of the things that we really want to think about is access and accessibility. And sometimes, you know, in common parlance, when we talk about access, we're talking about physical ability or disability in general in some kind of way. But we're also talking about, you know, do folks from a variety of different identities, whether those be ethnic or religious or gender, et cetera, will they feel comfortable using this service? Because as we really, you know, dig deeply into these issues, folks who are more likely to be harmed are folks who do come from places where their, you know, their identities are marginalized, whether that's a Black person or an Indigenous person or a trans person or what have you. So for us, it's really important to, you know, put the spotlight on that in terms of making sure we build anti-oppressive values and trauma-informed values into the service. And that's to say that, you know, a lot of folks who are marginalized also have, you know, to be quite honest, have had a history of negative experiences with law enforcement, in a variety of different ways, right? So, you know, we really want, and also, you know, before I go to my next point, you know, there are more and more statistics and reports coming out these days that do point to there being discrimination within law enforcement. So we really want to diminish and minimize the impact that, you know, what's happening there can have on people in terms of having negative outcomes as opposed to positive ones when they're already in distress, right? So, you know, just the last thing I'll say is that we've done so much community engagement just to really nail down what accessibility would look like for people. And that's not to say that we're done with that. You know, it's an ongoing check-in that I think we need to have as the service rolls along and, you know, the rollout happens and it starts to operate and that sort of thing, because society evolves, how we think about things evolves. So we also have to continue to check in with, you know, the service to say, are we doing well enough, you know, along these, you know, certain kinds of criteria.
Mm-hmm. As you were talking, I was thinking, I was just looking on my desk actually is Robin Maynard's Policing Black Lives and talking about state violence in Canada. And as well, you know, we're recording this just a couple of days after a massive, massive demonstration of this south of the border. Incoming President Biden talking about the fact that his granddaughter, I believe it was, had sent him a picture of the Washington area when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening during the earlier part of this pandemic of racism and economic and health issues. But we also saw yesterday, or the images coming out yesterday and the day before, of people who are doing, you know, violent, massive terrorist type violence in a context where they are not only not being met with the kind of force that peaceful protests were met with, but were actually, it looks like in many cases, being facilitated. So I would agree. I think, I hope that it's beyond dispute now, that we have the kinds of systemic racism, class bias, as well as the gender bias that you talked about, and the fact that no system is immune to that. And so the reality is that if I call in my privileged position the police and want assistance, I don't expect to be treated in a negative way, but too many of the people, including in my own family, who might call the police, expect to be treated in a negative way, in large part because of their life circumstances, because of their race, because of their class. And we need to address this in addition to the amazing and wonderful initiatives that you're undertaking, but by refusing to allow it to continue to happen without calling it out repeatedly. And I'm wondering, in terms of some of the work that your network is doing and the best practices that you've looked at, and you talked about some of the international examples, what are some of the approaches that you see that could be put in place that may need, and what kinds of resources, what kinds of training, what kinds of resources need to be put in place in order to make these kinds of responses, I'd like to say automatic, but at the very least, the expected response that we would see from the systems that would be called, whether it's the, you know, the emergency services, or, you know, I know in some places people have suggested separate lines that are specifically about mental health issues. And so I'm curious, what kinds of examples have you seen that you think could be imported? What do you need to, do you think we need to do as a sort of a made in Canada, made in Toronto, or is it dependent on each community how these services are developed?
I think the most important thing for us is that there really needs to be a paradigm shift as in relation to how we view mental health and a mental health crisis, and also in relation to how we view policing. Like right now, the way that people in general think about emergency services, you know, you have the fire department, which responds to fires, you have EMS, which responds to physical health crises, and then you have police that respond to everything else, including mental health. And what we sort of want to shift is that idea. We really want people to start seeing a civilian-led, a non-police response as the default, unless there's you know, a serious risk of violence or danger or threat, because that's really what police are for, right? Like, police exist to fight crime. Police exists to prevent violence and physical harm, although, you know, as we see in, for example, a couple days ago, what happened at the Capitol, they're not always effective at doing that. But, you know, if you think about why do police exist in society, they exist to do that. And, you know, mental health crisis is not a crime. Mental health crisis is a health crisis that requires a health response. And what we see, you know, one of the questions that we get all the time, our head and shoulders above any other question that we get, is, you know, if you create a civilian-led team, like, aren't people going to get hurt? Aren't your workers being put at risk? Aren't bystanders being put at risk? You know, aren't these calls dangerous and scary and violent? And aren't these people dangerous and scary and violent? And, you know, our network has done a ton of research on this question to figure out, like, is this actually true? And if it isn't true, why do people think that? Like, why do people think so consistently, no matter who we talk to, no matter where we go, this is the most frequently asked question? And, you know, what we see from the data is that very, very, very few mental health crisis calls involve any type of violence whatsoever. Very few calls involve weapons. We've looked at 911 call data. We've seen, you know, very, very, very few of these calls involve violence or weapons. And we've also talked to lots of international teams that, you know, have been operating for years. The team in Eugene, Oregon, CAHOOTS, they've been operating for 31 years, since 1989. They have never had a serious injury or death of a staff member. It's just, it's never happened. And they, you know, last year, 2019, they responded to 24,000 calls. And they've been doing that without police since 1989. They're dispatched via the 911 dispatch system. They're often responding to calls that, you know, in any other city, in Toronto, police are responding to. But in Eugene, CAHOOTS responds to them, and no injuries, no deaths ever. Mm-hmm. The same for other teams. And when mm-hmm. we think about, like, Asante and I have thought about, you know, why then, if this isn't borne out by the data, why do people have this idea, where does this idea come from? The mental health crisis is violent and dangerous, and sending mental health workers would be putting those workers at risk of death. Like, why do people think that? And what we've sort of hypothesized after a long time talking to people about this question is that it's because people associate police with crime and violence and danger. So when we see police responding to a person in mental health crisis, it sort of strengthens this association in our minds that, oh, well, police must be responding because that person is dangerous, because that person is scary, because that person is violent. And that creates stigma, a lot of stigma and a lot of misunderstandings about what a mental health crisis is and who people in mental health crisis actually are. So we hope that by taking police out of the equation and instead, you know, making it so that mental health workers are the default responders to these kinds of crises, and police only get called in when there is genuinely violence or danger, that will start to sort of break the stigma. And that, you know, that we see, for example, in Eugene, Oregon, like when people think of it, you know, when people see the person, you know, walking down the street, talking to themselves, flapping their arms, whichever, like the people calling that in, to if they're calling an emergency line like 911, you know, they're not saying, you know, this person needs police. Often they're saying, you know, this person needs CAHOOTS, because that idea there, because this team has been around for 31 years, it's really shifted and really changed the way people think. So we're really hoping that'll happen here too.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, as you both probably know, the Mental Health Commission has done a lot of work on the need to address stigma and exactly that myth that, in fact, people with mental health issues, even severe mental health issues, are not dangerous and violent. And in my experience, in, you know, approximately 40 years of working in and around prison systems and working with folks, many of whom have mental health issues, I can tell you that the default is often to presume, exactly as you've identified, that individuals with mental health issues equates to violence, even though there's not, even in situations where there is no evidence of it, or the only evidence of violence is violence that has come perpetrated at the hands of either the police or correctional, you know, or prison authorities. And so, you know, I think of the number of times, you know, that when I've been in the situations, sometimes of crisis situations in prisons or on the street, and inevitably how you treat someone is more indicative of how the person will respond than anything else. And so, you know, we know that virtually none of the Indigenous, in fact, no Indigenous police force in this country, who are first and foremost focusing on working in their communities, have killed someone. We know that those services that provide supports are less likely to be under threat, and it's more likely when state authority in a negative way is being exercised that we see any kinds of outbursts, if at all, as you've mentioned. And so, the other thing that I've certainly heard from lots of folks who are really struggling is, one of the facets of mental health that we're not really looking at is how much it's linked to the stress in people's lives, and everything from, you know, poverty, people living on the margins economically, people living without adequate, you know, without food security, without housing security, and how all of those actually exacerbate some of the behaviors that get articulated or described as mental health issues. And I'm wondering if there are links in the work that you're planning to do with some of those other initiatives, things like guaranteed livable income, things like housing, you know, homelessness and housing strategies, as well as the supports for folks to be able to feed themselves. We've spoken to people like Joe Gray and Paul Taylor in Toronto around the need to ensure food security, particularly in poor and racialized communities. And so I'm just curious as to whether you're linking in some of those resources as well as part of this.
I think that's a great statement, and I think a great question. You know, I think the first thing I'll say is we're definitely taking, you know, the sentiments of social determinants of health and mental health into you know, into the equation when we think about, you know, the service that we are proposing and advocating for. You know, I also want to add that, you know, discrimination is also a huge source of distress and stress for folks as well. You know, in terms of are we going to be directly involved in things like maybe, helping to provide housing or support to alleviate food insecurity. You know, I think for us, what we are hoping to do is connect with agencies that already do that really well and to build partnerships that way. And so that, you know, when we are making recommendations and we are thinking about, okay, you know, there's a crisis call or the distress call and the team arrives and, you know, the support is provided. What happens after that, you know, follow up, wraparound support, you know, what are the options there? Because again, many people are in crisis because of needs that aren't being fulfilled. So we want to help facilitate and advocate for the facilitation of having that warm handoff or the follow-up service or the wraparound service offered as a part of the crisis response or the distress response. So for us, it's not about us operating that ourselves. It's about highlighting how much of that those services already exist, you know, and making sure that those services are becoming integrated into the network of crisis response.
That's excellent, and agreed. Having to address the racism in those systems as well is going to be vital. So that's fantastic. Well, I'm super, you know, excited to hear about this. I'm very keen to do whatever I can to support. And I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add or anything that you're suggesting that people listening could be doing to help support this incredible work that you both and your network have been involved with and that will be continuing to advocate going forth.
I think if people want to learn more about the work that we're doing, again, they can go onto our website, reachouttoronto.ca, follow us on social media. And, you know, if people are interested in volunteering with us, again, they can get in touch with us via the website. But also just like keeping an eye on what's going on, you know, in Toronto, this council vote on this is going to be coming up pretty soon. There are a number of other cities across Canada that are doing similar work or that have, you know, that have motions that are going to be brought to their city council or to the province in relation to these kinds of issues as well. We know that Durham region in Ontario, for example, is working on that, on something similar. Parts of British Columbia are also interested. I think Vancouver had a motion that is going to be voted on probably in a few months. I'm not sure exactly what the date is on that. But just like letting your local government officials know that this is an idea that exists, like it is happening in a lot of places. It's not just like, you know, magic fantastical thinking. You know, these teams exist, they're being built in a lot of places, and now is really a good moment to be acting on the momentum that's already been built.
That's fantastic. Asante, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Definitely visit the website. For sure, do that and follow us on social, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You know, beyond that, I also encourage folks to get involved in their own communities. You know who you're, you know, who are the folks who are representing you in the communities that you live in. And if you are dissatisfied with something and you feel that it's a big enough issue, you know, reach out to your neighbors and community members and, you know, start to build a case for yourselves and then, you know, bring it to those who do represent you. And I think sometimes when we watch TV or read the news, we build these images in our head of who politicians are, how they are, and, you know, what they believe and all of these things. And one of the things that Rachel and I have really found in the last several months as we've kind of been walking down this path is that the large majority of politicians, whether on the municipal or provincial level or wherever, really, whether, you know, left, center, right, are open to listening and having a conversation about what community members are experiencing. So, you know, we do live in a democracy. And as part of that, we all have, you know, some might say a civic duty, but we all have some power as individuals and as communities to say that, you know, this is what we would like our communities and our society to look like, and, you know, approach the folks who have the power to, you know, maybe make some changes or modifications to say what you want or what you need. That's kind of how we started. We really just, you know, rounded up community members and, you know, got people to start talking to their local politicians and leaders. And things happened really quickly and rapidly. And here we are, we started less than a year ago at this. So, you know, it can be done. People do have, I think, more power than they think they do. And, you know, politicians are not as scary as we think they are. So, or as obstinate as we think they are. So let's do what we got to do to, you know, make the changes that we need to make in our society.
That's great. Well, thank you to both of you for the incredible work you're doing and the leadership. I look forward to following both of your careers. It's clear they're already well launched and your leadership. And I want to underscore something you just said, Asante, that is, you know, politicians are, you know, they're no better than anybody else. In fact, in this situation, we are public servants. We are expected to represent individuals. And when it comes to senators, one of the reasons that a number of us are here and we're interested and previously hadn't been involved in politics is part of our role is actually to represent the interests of those who often aren't represented by elected officials. So don't forget to call on us my colleagues. I'm saying we should all be reaching out. And I want to thank you for creating this Reach Out Response Network. I look forward to putting all of the information you've talked about in the show notes. Well, actually, I won't because I'm a techno twit, but Frigine will be making sure, the amazing Frigine who sets all this up. And we don't hear enough from her, but Frigine will be making sure that all of that information is in the show notes. And keep up the incredible work. Thank you for your commitment to this and for all of the the anti-stigma, anti-racist, anti-class work, the trying to fundamentally ensure that we actually support people to live in a society that encourages all kinds of health, including mental health. And so tons of appreciation for all you're doing, and look forward to continuing to support and follow and do whatever I can. So don't ever hesitate to reach out.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.